I'm Will. I'm Rock Hulk.
Hey, Will.
Tonight's speaker is a dear friend of mine. It's someone that I not only consider a friend and a confidant, but I consider a member of my family as well. He's got a real powerful story. You know, he's one of the ones that not only talks it, he lives it. Day in and day out, 24 hours a day. So without further ado, here's my best friend, Steve.
Hey everybody, I'm Steven. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Steve.
I started looking around, trying to figure out who he was talking about, but then he said my name, so I guess I kind of had to come up here. And I'm going to tell you guys a little bit about what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, just like it says I'm supposed to do in the book. I was actually born up in Philadelphia, and that was that. Then I moved down here when I was 9. So I was always kind of a chubby kid, and I was kind of a fat kid, and definitely was treated differently because of that. But the people I grew up with were still the people I grew up with, and so we had like a certain bond. And then when I moved down to Tampa when I was 9, I was still the fat kid, and I didn't grow up with these other kids, so I was treated differently. And you know, that's when it started to become obvious that people cared about like the way that you look and how you are. And so the thing I wanted most was to be accepted and like just have people to like take me under their wing and like me and be around me and want to be around me and want to like invite me over for sleepovers and, you know, what all that kind of silly stuff that you want to do as kids. And but I felt different from the beginning just because, you know, that mostly. And then, you know, up in Philadelphia, see, I'm Jewish. You're going to probably hear plenty about that in a minute. But I'm up in Philadelphia, it's not really a big deal. There's a lot of Jews all over the place, you know. And then you come down to Tampa, and, like, there's not. So, like, I that was something else. And I remember, actually, I was in fifth grade, so I'm 10 now. And not only am I physically different from my fellows, not only am I feeling like an outcast, but I decided it would be a really good idea to look like one too. And so, like, you might like see like little Jewish kids wearing their kippahs and having those little fringes coming out their shirts. Like, I did that just to be even that much more different, to get some attention. And like, that's why I did it. Like, I was like, oh yeah, it's gonna be cool, I'm gonna do it for purposes of like my religion. Yeah, I mean, I was kind of religious, but like, I mostly did it to get more attention, because that's what I saw. And I know it got the attention, just was usually negative. So that lasted all of a really long time, of a couple of months. I mean, that's how long that lasted for. You know, but I do remember, though, like, I mean, being Jewish, like, and traditionally living in a Jewish family, there's always eating going on. And, you know, on holidays, there's always wine to drink. And I know that it's actually part of the culture. Like, when you're 3 years old, you get your hair cut and you drink some wine. So I'm sure that I had my first drink at the latest at 3, but I don't really count that just because it's not something I remember. Don't remember any kind of feelings from it. but when I got down to Tampa, my rabbi every Saturday, I'm thinking about you Christians out there, every Saturday he would invite some of the adults in to his office and take shots of schnapps with them. And I always wanted to go. Again, it was part of it was because I wanted the acceptance. Since I'm an only child, I was always around adults, and you know, I felt like, okay, I'm one of the adults, and even though I never was, and I wanted to go with them and be part of that and to partake in what adults did. And that was what I saw, was to be invited into the rabbi's office to drink some schnapps. And I remember I was probably 11 the first time I went in there, and it was awesome. And I didn't just have one, I had two, because I was a tough guy and I really wanted to do it. And I liked it, actually. I mean, it was kind of cool. It was, you know, it was some high-grade whiskey, and I was really excited about it. And then there was scotch, and, like, I was even more excited about that because I thought it tasted like ginger ale, you know. And I tried to be, you know, even tougher about it and trying to fit in more with these adults that are minimum like three times my age, and you know, it's it was exciting though. So that's kind of the first thing I associated with drinking in general, was that. Now I didn't get drunk. It wasn't really enough to really get a feeling from it. The first time I really got a feeling from it was probably a little bit before that, when, you know, we would have like a dinner at the synagogue, and like me and a couple of my friends, we would go around all the tables and all the leftover wine, we would start downing them after the dinner, and we would definitely get tipsy and we had fun. So I mean, right off the beginning, you know, from a pretty young age, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old, like I'm enjoying going around and being, you know, mysterious and mischievous and drinking those little leftovers, and I'm having a fun time with my friends. But that was kind of where it took me, you know, in the very beginning. It didn't seem like a bad thing. It didn't seem like it was overkill, but that's really the beginning parts of me doing any kind of drinking at all. And then once I was invited into the rabbi's office for those shots after synagogue, I was always wanting to go in, and usually did. And so it was more of that acceptance. It was more like, okay, now I'm part of the clan. I got to go in there and do it. You know, that's what it was really about for me in the beginning. And I mean, that continued for a while, but that was it. You know, it never was really to the point where I would be getting loaded or anything like that. And then, and I was always heavily into sports, so I was kind of forced to do most of the right things. I was always a good student, always, you know, A's and B's was the grades for me, and like that was it. And playing sports, mostly baseball. I know, like, when I was younger, I played all the sports. But when I went to high school, you know, continued to do sports. I started doing wrestling, so like I'm always conscious about my weight and like trying to keep on track with it. And so I wasn't the fat kid anymore, which was kind of cool. But you know, I didn't really have time to go out and party per se. And the times that I did, you know, it was like the keg parties that high school kids throw, you know. And it wasn't until I was, because I couldn't really go to any that were far unless someone picked me up, and that only happened every now and again. It wasn't until I was 16. I went to Jacksonville to visit some friends, and we went over to another friend's house, and there was no parents there, and the dad had a liquor cabinet, and he was a doctor, so he had a lot in the liquor cabinet. And I mean, anything you could probably imagine that was in there was in there. There was so many different varieties, and since there wasn't any supervision, I'm like, all right, well, I gotta try some of everything. So we got all these different bottles, put them on the counter, on the coffee table in the middle of the room, and I just started slinging them back. I mean, I found out that I don't like gin at all. I found out that I like coconut flavored anything. And I found out that if it burns going down, I like that too. So, I mean, there was stuff like you don't drink by itself, but I didn't know that. I'm 16. I don't know how to drink properly, so I'm trying to figure it out. And I've never done it on my own like this before, so I'm definitely trying to be, you know, the hero and show everybody else how to do it. That's just how I was acting. And like, I ended up getting alcohol poisoning really badly. And my parents actually were in Orlando on vacation when I went up to Jacksonville. They had to cut their vacation short and come up and get me. It was pretty bad. I ended up consuming like 32 ounces of alcohol and less than an hour and a half. And apparently that's bad, but I wouldn't know that because I had never come close to doing anything like that. The last thing I remember before I blacked out, and that's the thing, is like, you'll find out, I'm a blackout drinker. The first time I got drunk, which is in Jacksonville, I blacked out, and the last time I got drunk, I blacked out. I mean, that's just from start to finish, always that way. And the thing is, too, that the longer I drank, the further down in my drinking career it got, the shorter time it took for me to black out. But in Jacksonville, like, it was really an exciting thing. And I mean, it talks about it in the book, like, you know, how easily it is to forget the misery that we feel. All I could remember was feeling like a superhero because I had drank so much, and like, it was really exciting, and I forgot like that I had a tremendous 4-day hangover. I forgot right away that happened. And when I got back, I'm like, okay, so now I know that probably isn't the best way to drink. So I'll, you know, just go to these keg parties. And by now I'm driving, so I can go myself. So I'm going to keg parties every weekend because the wrestling season's over and I don't have to worry about, you know, making my weight so that I can wrestle in my weight class. So then it's just baseball. And in high school, baseball kids like to drink, apparently. And they're always the hit of the show there, and we would have a lot of fun. And again, it was fun. I mean, that's the thing. Like, and I don't like to personally, when I'm talking to somebody, I don't like to tell them that it was always horrible, because that'd be a lie. Like, it was fun for a while. There was a point where it stopped being fun, but it was fun in the beginning. And like, I would go, and you know, I was just a weekend warrior. You know, I didn't drink every day. I never really got to that point. But I was a weekend warrior in high school, and still doing good in school, still playing sports, still doing all the stuff that I was supposed to do. And I thought that I was entitled to go and have a good time with other people that I decided would be my friends, whether they liked it or not, at these parties. And like I was saying earlier, like, that the thing I wanted most was to be accepted by people. And that allowed me to gain acceptance from people because, you know, because I got good grades, because both my parents were still married, because of certain things in my life, I felt like people looked down on me. So I had to, you know, stoop to a different level, whether it be up or down is kind of irrelevant. Like, but I had to go to a different level to get on other people's level, to play at their level, and that was to go to these parties and to drink. And, you know, I didn't know anything about, you know, any kind of spiritual malady. And, you know, looking back on it, it's really easy to see for me because of the amount of intensity I had towards my religion and towards God and towards, you know, being an active participating member of that society, basically, like, of that culture, versus when it stopped. Because it pretty much just fell off. It just rolled right off the table. And it was right at that time that it was more important for me to be accepted by people than for me to be accepted by something deeper than that. And that's where it kind of took off for me. And, you know, for me, you know, I know, like, this is, you know, geared as an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, but for me, it wasn't just alcohol. You know, I know a lot of people, a lot of young people will go and, you know, smoke weed all the time. I did that. You know, I did all kinds of different stuff that way, but, I mean, I am definitely an alcoholic through and through. There's no question in my mind about it, and honestly, I don't care what any of you guys say or anybody else out there. I know it, and that's all that really matters, you know, and that is really the basic point of what defines me as an alcoholic, and honestly, I'm grateful to be one because I got some normal friends, too, some earth people friends, and they're screwed. It's kind of sad, and I'm like, oh, you could use some step work. You're like, huh? Oh, well, don't worry about it. You gotta ruin your life a little bit first. Like, oh, no. Anyway, getting back to it, like, yeah, I mean, all the time throughout high school, just every weekend, pretty much, just partying. And then, you know, I was a manipulative little SOB, too. I remember I got a C in one of my classes. And I ended up talking a professor who doesn't do any kind of extra credit or extracurricular stuff whatsoever, who actually is a college professor who is teaching high school, and his wife was like one of the deans in the school. I ended up talking him into letting me do a paper for extra credit. I don't even think he read it, but he ended up bumping me up to a B. And it was just because I like sat there and talked to him. And I was talking to, you know, a couple of guys here outside of the meeting. Like, I'm a salesman through and through. And that's what I do for a living now. But like, I was manipulative then too, and I think that's a key requirement to be a good salesman. You have to be manipulative. So if that answers your question from earlier, that's probably one of the big things. But as far as that, like these are like things that pop up for me still, but mostly, you know, have been relieved for me. But, you know, these are things that took me through the pain and the suffering that I went through. You know, the manipulation that I had, you know, manipulating all the people around me, manipulating my parents, manipulating my so-called friends, you know, and it's easier to recognize that stuff now. And it's really, and I'll talk about it in a minute, but it's really because of going through this program and doing this program, not just sitting here and listening, but doing this program. And that's something I advocate all the time. And, you know, these are things that, like I said, took me to where I ended up being and ended up having to go through myself anyway. But, you know, honestly, it kind of puts me to a point where it allows me for growth, which is kind of cool too. And then, but going back to it, like I graduated high school sort of. I don't know, you know, if it's done everywhere and for how long it's been done, but there's always, where I went to school, they do a senior send-off. So they have a last day of regular class for high school students on a Monday, and then on a Tuesday is senior send-off. And senior send-off, there's always like a senior prank, and like there's no classes for the seniors, and they get to walk around and like hang out in the gymnasium or hang out in the stadium and sign each other's yearbooks. Well, the day before senior send-off, I thought it would be a really, really good idea to like expose myself to at least half the population in school. And like it was like all day, anywhere I could, hallways, classrooms, it's crazy. But I decided that would be a really good idea, and I thought it was. I mean, that was going to be my thing. And like I got to the last period a few minutes before the final bell rang for school, and I'm sitting in class, which was a really tough class. It was home ec, and it was hard. I mean, that was a hard class. But the phone rings in the front of the classroom, and my heart sinks. I'm like, oh, that's for me. That's calling me. So, and it was, and I got called up into the principal's office, and they like did the riot act on me, had a police officer in there, and like scared the crap out of me, and all these possibilities of me going to jail or having lawsuits and this, that, and the other. And so I'm like crapping my pants because I'm scared to death. And what ends up coming from it is like they suspend me for like 10 days, so I don't get to go to senior send-off. So in my senior yearbook, there are no signatures, and I didn't get to walk for graduation, you know. And probably the worst part of it was I didn't get to go to any of the parties. You know, that's what I was looking forward to. I could care less about the signatures in the yearbook, but it was the parties that I was looking forward to, and I wasn't allowed to go. So that was the biggest disappointment of something that could potentially have been tremendously, tremendously tarnishing for me. Like the biggest disappointment I had at that time was that I did not get to go to the parties. And then my parents caved and let me go to a family friend's party. So I was like, all right, yes, that's awesome. And then I remember, for that summer, it was really cool. It was awesome. I mean, I'm doing great at baseball. I get a scholarship to go play at a school over on the East Coast. And I'm really excited. I'm playing in a summer wood bat league. I'm excited about that. I'm doing really good at it. And then I need to go in and have surgery on my knee. And now I'm a catcher, catching the balls that the pitchers throw. And excuse me. And having surgery on your knees kind of sucks because you have to be squatted down the whole time. And I had this, like, I don't know, like a, it's called a Baker cyst in the back of my knee joint, and it was pretty painful. It was like the size of a golf ball, and like they ended up having to like cut my leg open. I got a big scar on the back of my leg, but like they ended up cutting the hamstring off to get to the knee, to the joint, taking this out, and then like basically retying my hamstring together. So for 8 months, I can't straighten my leg out. I'm not doing physical therapy because I'd rather do all kinds of other stuff that, you know, just doesn't go well with getting better. definitely drinking a lot. I mean, heck, I'm a freshman in college. You know, we've got a chess set that has wine glasses, or that has shot glasses, and every time you get a piece knocked off, you got to take the shot. And like, I was good at that game. I lost every time. I mean, it was awesome. You know, learning all kinds of drinking games. I mean, you got to have fun with that. And I remember, you know, being told one time about a blackout that I had, and it wasn't cool with me. Like, I wasn't okay with what I did in the blackout. And there's, you know, definitely some shameful things I've done in blackouts, and, you know, luckily I don't remember doing them. You know, and that's a blessing in and of itself, because then, you know, I just kind of take it for what people say it is versus what I know actually happened. And like, but I never liked blackouts because I liked remembering things that I was doing. I just didn't want to remember the bad things. So I think it was kind of subconscious that I blacked out a lot of times. But there was a lot of times that I definitely couldn't control it, especially when I was, you know, I know that talks about, I think it's on like page 7, you know, in the book, it talks about like doing little extracurricular things to help his drunk. Like, I would always do those little things to help my drunk out. And like, it was... that made it even that much more fun, but made it a lot more plausible for me to black out. So I did it a lot. I blacked out a lot in college. I remember in 2004 when there was a bunch of hurricanes that came through Florida. It's like Charlie, Jean, Ivan, Francis. Like, when those four hurricanes converged on Florida and just annihilated everything, my school closed down because it was in Melbourne. My school closed down for 2 weeks. You couldn't drive anywhere. Everything was destroyed. So I come back to Tampa, and I pretty much spend 2 weeks in a crack house, not smoking crack, but definitely drinking and smoking weed the whole time, like literally for 2 straight weeks. And that was really the first time I ever drank every single day. Was there, and I thought it was a blast because I got to be the big guy on campus, so to speak, because one of my friends who was at the school with me lived in Kentucky and couldn't go home, so he came with me. And like, I bring him to a place like that, and like, I think I'm awesome because of it, because, you know, I took him to a place where he could do what both of us wanted to do all the time. And, you know, it's unfortunate, and I don't have the opportunity to make direct amends to him. And the reason why is because he's dead. And I always thought that, like, for a while, I always thought it was my fault, because I provided with something that I thought he might have overdosed on, and it ended up being that it wasn't, but I still felt that way. He ended up dying of a brain tumor, but I still don't get to make direct amends to him. I have to make other amends to him. You know, and it's kind of unfortunate that I don't get to do that, because it's really an amazing feeling. You know, the amends that I have had a chance to make have been an amazing feeling, and I don't get to do that with him. And, you know, I took him to this crazy place, you know, but and I did other things too that were not becoming of a friend. Get back to school 2 weeks later. I think I'm doing a nice thing. I'm taking another buddy who's got his car in a garage up in Cocoa Beach. It's like 40 miles away. I'm like, all right, yeah, man, come on, hop in. I'll take you up there. And then I got pulled over for speeding, which I didn't know. There was no lights, no traffic signs, no speed signs. So I got pulled over for speeding, and I ended up getting arrested. And I thought that was a joke, too. I thought that was fun and exciting. And because I had never been arrested before, and I remember getting processed and put in a little cell, and then the arresting officer, you know, comes to like let me out, and he says that he can take the handcuffs off of me. And this is why it was fun, because I ended up like just taking them off myself and handing them to him, because I guess they were loose enough where I could slip my wrists out, and it was really cool. I was like, yay! And he looks at me like I'm an absolute moron. I mean, it's one of those looks like you don't forget, you know what I mean? And I thought it was fun. I thought it was exciting. And so the first thing that I do when I get back to the little village I was living in, the little apartment / dorm that I was living in, the first thing I do is I fill up a water bottle with vodka, the whole thing, and just gulp the whole thing down. And I mean, I just thought that would be the right thing to do. I mean, you get arrested, first thing you want to do is get really, really drunk. And see, this was like the quintessential thing that I used to like to do. I used to like to drink fast and hard. If I had liquor, that's what I liked to do. So that, and this was the thing, like, I remember specifically the feeling of it just coursing through my body. You know, the warmth that it had going through my arms and through my legs. I specifically lived for that. Honestly, like, the part of being sloppy drunk wasn't really what did it for me. It was that feeling. It was that feeling. And the feeling of, like, drinking all this stuff all at once and being able to keep it down, too. Because it was a hassle, like, you know, continual, like, okay, am I going to? I got to stand outside, try to catch some fresh breath. And then once I could feel it going through my body, I knew I was good to go. And that was it. I ended up getting kicked off the baseball team because I wasn't rehabbing my leg, so I couldn't be of any use to them. And, like, I started getting skinnier and skinnier and skinnier because, I mean, I'm drinking and doing other stuff all the time. Like, I don't have time to eat. Like, it's a chore to eat, and, like, I didn't even realize it at the time, but, like, they just can see me deteriorating, and it's funny because, you know, we talk about it in here sometimes, and, like, it's the pain that motivates us to do something different. It felt like I was being a failure when I got kicked off the baseball team, and so then I started to rehab my leg. Like, I don't know, a normal person would probably do it the other way around. But I don't know a darn thing about what it means to be a normal person, so I do everything completely backwards, and that's what I did there as well. I ended up leaving Melbourne. I left that school because, you know, I was there, but I didn't realize that. I just thought it was, there's nothing to do in Melbourne. I can only go to the beach so many times a day, and there's nowhere to go, there's nothing to do, and I hate this place. So I came back to Tampa and finished up over at USF, and you know, when I came back to Tampa, I got a job, and I ended up buying a house, and I ended up continuing through school, and things seemed to be going pretty well. I could walk again. I had a girl that moved over here with me. She gave up a lot of stuff. She had like a full ride to that school for another sport. You know, she gave up all of that stuff that she had over there to come, like, live with me, and then by the end of summer, she moved away. That's just, I would drive people off, you know, and I, like I said, eventually I got a great job, you know, during that summer, and then got a house, and things were going well. And then that job allowed me to, like, travel and move to Tennessee to open up an office up there. And then the following summer, moved down to Sarasota. In the meantime, I've got another girl that I bring around. And that's always a downfall of mine. You know, if it's not drinking, it's girls. If it's not girls, it's something else. If it's not something else, it's something else even further down the line. Like, it doesn't matter. There's always going to be downfall if I'm running the show, and that's what I've come to find out. But I end up, when I'm in Sarasota, I think it's 2007, the summer of 2007, I'm in Sarasota, I open up an office down there, and I end up, in 1 week, the girl leaves, my grandfather dies, and my business closes down because there's no money left because I've been squandering everything that I've been making on, you know, on drugs and alcohol. Like, that's just all there was to it. And so, like, I left all these people that were working for me basically out of a job. You know, I feel like everything is tumbled and fallen apart, and it feels like the end of the world for me. And, like, my parents were really worried about me because they didn't hear from me, didn't know anything about what's going on for a while, and end up coming to get me and bringing me back, get rid of the house. I end up moving back in with my parents in summer of 2007, and it was from then until I went to a treatment center in November of 2010, it was the exact same thing. The whole time. I was in my room by myself the whole time. I had nobody to talk to. I had nobody to listen to me. I had nobody to go hang out with. I mean, there was intermittent times where I would actually get out of the house. But, I mean, I'm talking, like, once a month for a couple of hours. Or to go get what I needed so I could be in the house by myself for that entire time. You know, I ended up stealing from my parents, taking full advantage of them on a regular basis. You know, I've got no income. I've got nothing. And, like, for the whole time, it was just tremendously horrible. There was a time period in there where I just, I wanted to stop. Like, I didn't want to live that way anymore. And it was towards the beginning. It was like, I don't know, August, September, October-ish of 2007, where I couldn't do it anymore. I felt like I was falling apart. And I blamed it on drinking and doing the drugs. Like, that's what I blamed it on. And my mom got me in to see a doctor to get me on some medication to kind of get me off everything. And behind that doctor's office, there was like an intensive outpatient facility that was being ran. So they checked me into there. It wasn't like a day treatment facility, but they checked me into there, and I was supposed to come back the next night because they did it like three nights a week for 3 hours at a time. Now, mind you, the jobs that I have at this time, I'm umpiring baseball games, and I'm doing a little bit of tutoring here and there. I mean, probably taking up a total of 10 hours in my week. And they want me to come back there three nights a week for a total of 3 hours apiece. I don't have time to do that. I'm a busy guy. And these are things that I'm telling them. Like, I've got nothing but time, but it was going to cut into what I wanted to do, which was nothing. Literally nothing. I wanted absolutely nothing to do. And the only reason I did any of those, you know, did any of those little odd jobs is because I needed to have some kind of money to buy what I needed. Like, that's the only reason. I worked because I needed to get loaded. That was it. You know, because my parents didn't have anything else to give me. But I went back the next night to that little intensive outpatient, and they're like, okay, well, this is the last time where you're going to be able to come here because we don't have any funding and we're closing. So I never got an opportunity to even know that there was a possibility of a solution. They handed me a bunch of books, but I never looked at them. Like, I didn't know, and that was it. And, like, we had, like, a little circle group and that night, and, like, the things that these people were saying, like, really? Come on. Like, you can't deal with that? I mean, how I deal with that is I get loaded. Like, what's the big deal? Like, and that's all I knew. That's it. And then, literally, that's how it continued for the next 3 years. And November of 2010, I think it was, like, November 10th, my parents, you know, or November 9th, my parents basically had intervention for me because I'm still living in their house, you know, doing absolutely nothing with my life. And I've got two degrees from USF, and I'm not doing anything. And they had enough. And basically what put them over the straw was that I was still stealing from them. Specifically my mom, who was getting all kinds of goodies because she just had a double mastectomy, so she had all kinds of goodies, and I was stealing them. Like, that's why they had enough. And basically had an intervention on me and were telling me that they were gonna get me help whether I liked it or not. Like, I had a choice. I could move out of their house, or I could do what they're telling me I had to do. And 2 weeks prior to this, I totaled my truck, so I didn't have any means of transportation anymore. I didn't have anybody that I could talk to. The only person I had any kind of loyalty to as a friend was squatting in houses. Like, so it'd be the same thing. And he didn't have a steady phone number, so I didn't know what number to call him on that week. Didn't have a car, so he was in the same position I was in. And so I'm like, all right, well, I guess I'll go get some help. They end up, the next day, on the 10th, that buddy I was just talking about ends up combing over to my house during the day while my parents are doing what normal people do, which is being at work. And my buddy brings over one beer for me from the gas station, from, you know, one of those little stops there. Brings over one beer for me, and I don't even get halfway through before I black out. Like, one beer. from stark sober to half a beer and blacked out. And I mean, that's not fun. No fun at all. So like in that 3-year time period, it went from being able to get drunk to blacking out after half a beer. And that's just kind of what it took me to. And I ended up coming to in detox with the nurse taking blood out of my arm. I'm looking around like, this is kind of weird. I'm in a little hospital room and that's what's going on. Okay. I don't know why I was so calm about it. Like, it seemed like I would be more crazed about what was going on from sitting at in my house to coming to in a detox facility. Well, the craziness came very soon thereafter. I guess I got some sleep, and the next morning is when it started. And by 9 o'clock that night, they kicked me out of detox. I'm not sure like how you get kicked out of detox, but I found a way to do it. And then the doctor who facilitated that place, that detox center, suggested I go to Turning Point of Tampa. And again, I mean, like, I'm still doing the same things. I'm still umpiring and tutoring. And, I mean, I'm much too important to be gone for 30 days. You know, I've got, you know, all these couple of kids that I have to continue to work with that they can't be without me. I mean, needless to say, during this time frame that I've been tutoring them, I'm getting loaded the whole time, you know, and slurring my words, and they can't understand me, showing up late or not showing up at all, calling and being like, oh, I'm sick, you know, and it just, they were way better without me, like, but I couldn't see it. I couldn't see it at all. And so I end up going to treatment, and I wasn't very pleasant for the first 10 days in treatment. Because I didn't detox, because I refused their medications for detoxing, I refused anything, I yelled and screamed about everything I possibly could. They had those two lampshades on the walls there, and I mean, I saw God, and man, did I argue, because one of my degrees is in philosophy, so not only am I Jewish, not only do I have a philosophy degree, but I had an opportunity to see these things before and how screwed up everybody else was that was trying to look at them. So I've got all kinds of ammunition to tell you why that's not going to work. And it took me 10 days to go through detoxing, basically, cold turkey, inside of a treatment facility, in a village there. And like, they would take us to meetings, and I would go to as few as possible. And I didn't hear anything. All I did was spout. And it was all just pure BS that came out of my mouth. And it was always angry. I remember, the first thing I said when I got into treatment, because my mom dropped me off at 8 o'clock in the morning, said bye, and drove off. Like, they were done. I mean, absolutely done with me. And, you know, bless them for being done with me. I needed that really, really badly. Because I felt like I had nowhere else to go, because I'm much too pretty to live on the streets, so... that wasn't for me. I didn't say anything, like, at all. I had to do an admissions, but that was it. And I ended up sitting in the waiting room. I guess they thought I was, like, just still messed up, like, still loaded from, which wasn't until, like, the 10th, you know. I hadn't done anything since I went to detox, but I guess they thought I was still loaded, and... I mean, I was crazy, but I mean, I'm angry and really mean and not talking to anybody, so they probably just thought I was messed up. But they made me sit there in the waiting room from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., and I've got nothing. I mean, I've got a book, because that's all I like to do, is just sit by myself and read when my eyes can see. And that's all I did, was just sit there and read. And then, like, the first thing I said was really messed up. The house manager that was there took me back to my room, gave me some sheets to put on the plastic bed. I try to put the sheets on. He goes downstairs because they had to take my books, and that wasn't okay with me either, because that's all I have. Takes my books to lock them up until I leave. Comes back up to see if I need anything, to see if I'm getting everything set up. And the first thing I do is yell at him about how the sheets didn't fit the bed. Now, I used a lot more exciting and colorful language, but that's the first thing that happened. That's the first thing I said to anybody that was associated to being a house manager or anybody there. And my two roommates that lived in there walked by the door when I said that. And later I found out, like 2-3 weeks later, they came up to me like, man, we had a 3-day over-under on you. And I was like, I would have taken the under, you know, for how long I would stay there. But again, I didn't have any, I felt like I had nowhere else to go. So I felt like I kind of had to stay, you know. And like I said, it was about 10 days at that detox for me, like, to get it all out of my system. And I went to, they took us to a 6:30 a.m. meeting over at Yana, and I went, because I wasn't sleeping. I mean, I'm still detoxing, so I'm not sleeping at all. Might as well get these necessary meetings that I have to attend and put on a piece of paper. Might as well go and get them taken care of as early as possible so I can just screw off the rest of the day anyway and pretend to be available in groups and whatnot. And I couldn't tell you what it was that I heard, but something that I heard made me kind of want to pray a little bit, which was kind of weird for me because it had been a long time since I had actually given a real prayer. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to do it. So I did it the only way that I knew how to do it from before. And I have like these prayer straps that you put on your arm and your head, and I'm putting them on, and I live in the second floor, on the second floor, and there's a balcony that leads down to a stairway, and I'm out on the balcony. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. I'm putting on these prayer straps, and the next thing I know, I'm in an ambulance car, and the next thing I come to in the hospital, and apparently I had a really bad seizure, but and I cracked my skull open. So a lot of the people I was in treatment with ended up calling me Stevie Stapes, or, you know, Staples or something like that. And, you know, so it was a little bit of a nickname, and I got to fit in. You know, it was cool. People gave me a nickname. But, you know, I ended up talking about it in meetings later on at that treatment facility after I had gotten out of there. And I talked about the story that happened, and I talked about it as if a lightning bolt was sent down from God and struck me in the head. And there was even people that came up to me after, like, "You got struck in the head by lightning?" Like, I mean, it was figurative, obviously, and I told them about that. Some of them, I tried to, like, keep going with that story that I got struck in the head by lightning. But the reason why I always said that is because, and I don't understand what happened, but when I went to the hospital, one of the things I was detoxing on, they told me that I can't just stop. Like, they have to give me more to wean me off of it, and that's what caused the seizure. I'm like, well, no kidding. You know, I'm aware of this, and that's why I never stopped in the first place. And the word no came out of my mouth when they tried to give it to me. And, I mean, that was not something that I ever do. I never turn down anything you try to give me, no matter what it is, and I turned it down. And, like, I don't have that ability to say no to those kinds of things. I do now. I strongly believe that I do now have the ability to do so. I have that power of choice now, but at that point in time, I did not. But that, the word no came out of my mouth. And the preceding 5, 6, 7 times they tried to offer me it again, I knew it was possible to say no because it had already happened once. And I strongly, strongly believe that was that first time that I said no was God saying no for me, because I couldn't. I mean, if I couldn't and it still came out of my mouth, I don't know where it came from. I mean, that's the only possible explanation for it in my book. And, you know, that was really, looking back on it, you know, even just a couple months after the fact, that was really my first God moment. That was really my first spiritual experience, and I didn't even know it at the time. And that's why I talked about it as like a lightning bolt, because when I got back to, I wanted to go back to the treatment facility. Like, I wanted to. And previous to that, I wanted nothing to do with it. It was truly a perspective change. Truly was. It was the first time that I truly ever wanted not to keep doing what I was doing. And, like, I never had that experience before. I toyed with that idea previously when I tried it out, and I just kind of, like, shunned everything about it. But I truly wanted not to. And, I mean, part of it was because I was going to meetings, and meetings were coming into the treatment facility, and, like, there's people that are happy, and they're all full of BS because they're telling me that they're sober for a year, 2 years, 5 years, more than that. Like, that's not true, but they seem happy anyway. Like, I still just want to be happy. And a little I find out that really was true. But at the time, I couldn't possibly fathom something like that. I mean, I thought that one of the guys that was in the treatment facility for 90 days was amazing. He was the man because he just picked up 90 days. That I could understand. You know, and now it's like, okay, he's only got 90 days. Like, that's awesome. It's huge. But, I mean, that's only a stepping stone. You know what I mean? And it was, I thought he was the coolest thing in the world. And, like, it was incredible. And that's what I could grasp. At that point in time, I could grasp, you know, 60 and 90 days. Anything more than that was crazy and false. And, you know, then I got to 90 days. And then I got to 6 months. You know, and by this time, I'm already, you know, in my steps. I get out of treatment. I start working on the steps right away. And, like, it was great. One, then the next week, two, then the next week, three. That's how I did it with my sponsor. It's how I do it with my sponsees. Then time, like 4 months goes by. I'm like, things are going well for a little while. Things are going great for a minute. And then all of a sudden I'm like, man, this is weird. I feel weird in my own skin. I feel crazy. And I was. I mean, I'm sitting on all this crap that I had done. And my sponsor's like, well, have you been working on your four step? I'm like, yeah. He's like, have you been working on your four step? I'm like, all right, no. He's like, well, do it. So I ended up doing my four step, doing my fifth step with him. Didn't really have any immediate relief until I went back to my place, sat for an hour like it talks about in the big book, and like actually felt clear. That was my relief in the beginning, was I felt clear. Just like my head wasn't going a million miles a minute anymore. And, you know, that was really a cool feeling. And then continued. I actually continued from that point. I didn't have a 4 month pause again. Like, I continued 6, 7, 8. All of a sudden, I'm at 9. I've made my list. I'm at 9. And my parents want me to go on vacation with them. I mean, this is huge. You know, for me, it was huge. And, by the way, my place, I lived in a halfway house for 8 or 9 months, and it was probably the most inspirational experience that I could have ever had. I met the most amazing people there. You know, I always had somebody from this program around me at all times. So it gave me the ability not to have to worry. Not to have to worry, because even if I was there by myself, like, I ended up getting a job, so like that I still have today, which is baffling, like a real job. But even though I got a job and I was gone early in the morning and I got back late at night after going to a meeting, even if I got there and I was the only one there, I knew somebody was going to come home. And that if I needed to talk to one of them, they were going to listen. And if they were going through some crazy stuff, they knew they could talk to me. Like, that was huge for me. But it's July 4th weekend, my parents take me over to the East Coast, up to the beach, and, like, perfectly timed. I just got done doing my A-step. My sponsor tells me that I have to make some direct amends now, and I don't know how to do it, so I ask him for assistance, and, like, how do I go about by doing this? He's like, well, first of all, it's not a sorry fest. They know you're sorry. You know you're sorry. You've been sorry all your life. Do something different. So I began an amends process with my parents that weekend. And I say began because a lot of the things that are with my amends towards them directly is a continual life thing. Just plain and simple. Like, it's not, I can't say, okay, I'm sorry for this, this, and this, or I did this, this, and this, you know, and here's how, what I'm, you know, it's what I'm not going to do again. Like, that's what my amends to them is, continuing to live this way of life and not doing the crazy, crappy stuff that I used to do to them. And that's how all of my amends processes have gone so far. I haven't had a bad one, honestly. I know some people have some horror stories with them. I don't. They've all been tremendously beneficial. Some of them have been, like, I make the direct amends, and I think, okay, well, now I'm going to probably see this person more, talk to this person more, and, like, it goes 9 months before I talk to them again. But, like, it's like we're little kids again, you know, and it's nice. You know, and I get through the rest of the steps, you know, just like my sponsor told me to do, just like he directed me to do, you know, calling people, calling him, getting everything that I always wanted. You know, I always wanted to have the acceptance, and now people knew about me and knew what I had done and knew how I had been, and yet they still love me and care about me and, you know, treat me like a human being, and it's crazy. And like it's an amazing, amazing thing to have real, true friends. It's an amazing, amazing thing to know that, you know, I've got my boys that I can hang out with, that they can come hang out with me, I can go hang out with them, we can do all kinds of things, and we can be happy in each other's presence, and you know, joke around, and just be ourselves, and not have to try to put on a face, and try to put on a front, and be something else, and be someone else that I'm not. I don't have to do that. I have real people in my life that care about me that I care about. Plain and simple. And it's amazing. You know, got through my steps. My sponsor tells me after we work on step 12, we talk about it, we do a little bit about it, but he said that I'm not doing step 12 until I'm actually active in doing some service. And the best way for me to get active in some service is to start sponsoring somebody immediately. I'm like, so now I have to raise my hand? And yeah, first time I raise my hand, someone comes up to me and asks me to be their sponsor. I mean, I don't know, that was pretty awesome. And he's in treatment at this time, not anymore, but he was in treatment, and like, I went to his treatment facility, I talked to him for sometimes hours at a time, I would see him at meetings, he would talk to me on the phone. I mean, I was being a sponsor, and I thought it was the coolest thing, and it was really, honestly, probably the nicest thing that I've ever done in this program or in life in general. And the best thing that I've ever seen and had the experience of being part of is to take someone else through the steps. It really, really is. And it sounds so cheesy. Like, I've heard other people say it from the podium. I'm like, that sounds so ridiculous. But honestly, man, it's awesome. When you're working with somebody else, when this is my experience, and when I was working with this new guy who's telling me how willing he is and how amazingly excited he is about getting sober, and I'm... That's great. You keep thinking that. I mean, he was so full of crap. So full of crap. Just like I was, though. I mean, that's exactly what happened. And, you know, seeing the dullness in his eyes turn to a bright light, and this kid smiling, and this kid doing his step work and going through the steps, and then sponsoring someone else and having the opportunity to see that also has just been... That's how it's been. I can't even describe it. I mean, it's pretty awesome. You know, I don't really know how to describe exact feeling that being a participant in this program, being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, makes me feel, other than just purely gracious. I mean, all I ever wanted was to be accepted, to be happy, to be joyous, to be free, and I am that today. No questions about it. I mean, some crazy messed up stuff can be going on directly in my life that someone else is participating in, or something else that someone's trying to drag me into some drama, and I just don't have to be part of it. It can still be going on. I don't have the ability to control what's going on, but I don't have to be really a part of it. And, like, that's so nice to know that, like, if I'm not trying to run the thing, like, it's going to be okay. It really is. My favorite page in the big book is page 417 in the fourth edition. It really, really is. And he's out there laughing because he knows it too. My sponsor, like, I was feeling really upset at one point in time, because I didn't have a car still at this point in time. I didn't have a car. I was still working, but I worked 35 minutes away from the halfway house I was living in. So another guy that was living in the halfway house who got my foot in the door at this place was taking me to work every day. And he had this girlfriend of his that was coming with us every morning and taking his car afterwards. And I'm like, I couldn't stand the girl. I was in treatment with her, and then she wasn't in the program anymore, and then she was, and then she wasn't, and I just, making me nuts, you know, and it's because I cared about this guy, and I still do care about this guy. And my sponsor said, you need to not feel like you have to control it and just let it go. I'm like, well, how am I supposed to do that? Well, why don't you read page 417 every morning before he comes and picks you up? So I started doing that. I mean, I'll tell you what, within like 10, 12 days, I stopped caring. And not in like in an efforts type of not care about it anymore, but like, it is what it is kind of care, not care about it anymore. You know, it tells me on page 417 that if I accept what I am and I don't try to run the show, then everything's going to be all right. It's when I'm not trying to run, it's when I am trying to run the show that I've got a problem with the way that the world turns. And it doesn't matter, I mean, honestly, it doesn't matter what it is that you believe makes the world turn, but if I have no capability of making the world turn. I can't make any of you show up here tonight or anywhere else tonight or do any of that kind of stuff. I can't make a tree grow. Something does. I'm not here to tell you what it is, but something does, and I believe that there's something that does make that happen. But if I'm the one that believes that I make it happen, all of a sudden I've got a problem with what's going on in the world. And that's where, when I run into issues at all, that's always the core of it, that I'm trying to take my will back, that I'm trying to run the show. And when I don't run the show, I'll tell you what, man, things are awesome. Thanks for letting me share.
Thanks. Thank you, Steve.
Truly appreciate your story.